listening to the CCA Podcast.
For the Christian church, it's the most important day of the year. I don't know, Good Friday and Easter are really close in terms of importance, but they're kind of one unit. They fit together. I mean, you don't have one without the other. Because Easter without the crucifixion, well, it wouldn't have happened because Jesus needed to die before he rose again. And then the crucifixion without Easter, well, his death would have just been another death, one of thousands, one of more multiple thousands that took place as a prescription for someone's misdoing and malfeasance, which is what they thought they were killing Jesus for. And the resurrection shows that, well, in fact, that was not the case. The resurrection story that we have been observing, actually we've been going through the book of Mark for the past 3 months. So in January, February, and March, we've been walking through the story of Jesus from the book of Mark, and we've been, the whole idea is to get to know Jesus better and to not only get to know him better, but to fall more in love with him. Because that's what happens, is when we get to know Jesus better, we discover more and more just how incredible he is and how what an incredible Savior we have. So we're going to look at the very last section of Mark, the section on the resurrection, and it's in the last chapter of Mark, chapter 16 and verses 1 to 8. So it'll be up on the screens. You can also look in your own Bibles or in your phones if you'd like. And it goes like this. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Now, just so we understand the chronology here, so Jesus, as far as we can best understand, was crucified on a Friday. There's some who actually believe that because there was a special Sabbath day, a holy day, that the Passover was also called a Sabbath, that Jesus may actually have been crucified on the Thursday, and that there were two Sabbaths in a row, but that's kind of technical. Anyway, traditionally we think, okay, he was crucified on a Friday. And sometimes we think, well, 3 days, what's this 3 days in the grave business? It only feels like two to me. Well, what happened was in a Jewish calendar, the day goes from sundown to sundown. So Jesus was crucified on the Friday and put into the tomb before the day ended. So before sundown, they were hurrying up to do it because the Sabbath actually started on sundown on then the Saturday. And so he was placed in the tomb on Friday afternoon. And so part of Friday he's in the tomb, then Saturday. So then Saturday is over on Saturday evening at sundown. The Sabbath ends. And so Salome and Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James can now go and do commerce, kind of normal. Commerce is open again at the end of the Sabbath. And so in that evening, they go and they collect the spices and carry them and get them ready to bring to the tomb then on the next day, Sunday, the first day of the week. So the 3 days in the tomb are part of Friday, all of Saturday, and part of Sunday. So they go and they buy the spices, and very early on the first day of the week, that is the Sunday, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb? Now, see, they were unaware of the fact that after they had left the tomb, after Jesus had been placed there, that the Pharisees and scribes had come to Pilate and said, hey, his followers said that he's going to die and rise again in 3 days, and we want to make sure that there's no monkey business going on with them coming and stealing the body and proclaiming, oh, he's risen again. So make sure you guard and seal this tomb. And the women, though, were unaware of that fact. They hadn't visited it in the meantime. And so they're thinking to themselves, oh, man, that huge stone that's there. The stone, it was very typical of Jewish sepulchers. There would be kind of a trough in front of the opening to the tomb, and you would put the stone in that and roll it then in the trough into then a little lowered section, and it would kind of fit down tightly then up against the entrance to the tomb. And they're thinking, man, this thing is heavy, and we're going to have to try to push this huge stone out of this little indentation in the trough. We're not sure we can handle that. So they're thinking about this. But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white, in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. Now, Mark doesn't specify that this is an angel, but it's pretty clear he's given an announcement. He's dressed in white. He's there. The word angel actually means messenger, and so he's a messenger from God. And he says to them, "Don't be alarmed." This word "alarmed" is actually one of the strongest for fear. It's basically saying, "Don't be terrified." They were terrified when they saw him. They don't know what's going on. They came, they're expecting a tomb closed, it's open, and now there's a guy sitting in it, and he says, "You're looking for Jesus the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him?" Now, in a typical tomb, there is a kind of an antechamber at the front, and then a smaller door to go back into the actual sepulcher where the person is, you know, where the body is laid. So very likely, it's interesting, Mark says he's on the right side. I mean, all these details, you know, they're remembering this. We came into the tomb, and there's this guy dressed in white, and he's on the right side. And he says, "Don't be terrified." And we were terrified. And then he says, "No, come on in and look and see where he laid." And so they go into the narrow little door and look inside. And wow, there are the grave clothes, but he's not there. Now, Mark doesn't give this information, but John does, and he explains out of his own experience how that when he went in and ran and looked inside the tomb, that he saw the grave clothes lying there and the headband separate, the headpiece separate. And it says, and it was rolled together. And so we're trying to imagine, okay, what exactly was it that John saw when he went in and the women saw? Well, typically, a person, after they were killed, or after they died, they would put spices in the rolls of cloth, and they would wrap them tightly, about a foot wide linen cloth, and up to the armpits, and then there would be a covering around the head as well, and it would be rolled around the head. And so it's likely that what John saw and the women saw as they went in, so they go in there, and here are these grave cloths, and they've sunk down because of the weight of the spices that are in them. But then the headpiece is sitting there by itself, rolled together, and it's possible that what's implied by that is that it still had the shape of the head. It was rolled together, and there's the shape of the head, and then the grave cloths, and it's like, whoa! This is not normal. There isn't some guy who just kind of struggled. He was maybe still alive and kind of struggled his way out of here. And it's not like someone came and took it. It's like it just, boom, was gone. So the young man says, but go tell his disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And with that, Mark ends his gospel. Now, that's kind of a weird note to end it on, right? It's like, and they were afraid. It's so honest. It's so real. The women were terrified, and they're still terrified, and at first they don't even say anything to anyone. You know, the church kind of had a little bit of a difficulty with that ending in Mark's gospel. And so subsequently they added some of the details that happened and put it down. And if you're looking at your Bible, it may say something to the effect of the most reliable early manuscripts do not have Mark 16, 9 through 20. And there's a whole section of Jesus giving a commission to the disciples and all that, things that actually happened, but they weren't written by Mark. Because, and I can just kind of imagine, you know, people coming to Mark and saying, Mark, you ended your gospel with the women fearful and not saying anything. That's not a really good way to, you know, to end it. I mean, this is the most powerful message in the world, and you ended it like that. And I can just kind of imagine Mark saying, hey, what I wrote is what I wrote, and I'm sticking with it. And you change it if you want, but I'm not changing it. So they added this extra section, but Mark leaves it with the women being afraid. And then it kind of like, okay, well, yeah, I guess they went up to Galilee. Well, yes, they did go up to Galilee, and they did see Jesus. So it's interesting how essential this message of the resurrection is. It's right at the very core of Christianity. In fact, the Bible says that unless you believe it, you're not a Christ follower. You're not a Christian. You can't call yourself a Christian unless you believe this message. The Apostle Paul, he said it this way. He said, if we confess with our mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in our hearts that God has raised him from the dead, then we'll be saved. But we can't be saved unless we believe it. And sometimes I think we think of, okay, believing in my heart, and we think of, oh, that's a little kind of squishy, you know, that's kind of emotional. I've got to sort of have this strong feeling of, strong feeling inside that Jesus is risen again from the dead. But for the Greek mind, the heart did not represent feelings. Feelings were in the gut, visceral. The heart was actually the center of the center of intellectual life and the center of the core of my being. So to believe in my heart is to say, I really stand on this stuff. Unless you believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you won't be saved. There are a lot of people who kind of argue that, well, Jesus is, I like Jesus. I like what he taught. I like the way he offered up his life for others. I like the fact that he said, turn the other cheek and love your enemy and do good to those who despitefully use you. That's really amazing. I love that part. But the resurrection, I just, you know, can't really grab onto that because dead people don't rise. And in fact, there are probably in religious faculties, different seminaries actually around the world that teach that actually it's a very strong historical problem, this idea that Jesus rose again, and that we don't need that. That we can just hold on to Jesus' teaching and that's enough. We don't need the resurrection. And a lot of people would argue that basically we believe the resurrection because we want to, because it's like a wish fulfillment. And what happened, you see, was that the people back then, they were more gullible than we are, and they believed in stuff like the resurrection. So they were waiting for it to happen. So they could easily fall prey to reports that, oh, people had seen Jesus. They believed that he was the Messiah and that he died, and they began to sense that he was with them and guiding them and living in their hearts. And so over the decades, these feelings developed into stories that Jesus really had risen. In fact, Dan Brown in The Da Vinci Code, you know, he kind of argues that, well, basically this idea of the resurrection, that's not what the early church believed. It developed with time, and by the time that Constantine came into power, then he officially declared the resurrection of Jesus as official state doctrine and dogma, and it's at that point that people then began to accept it. And the problem is that makes sense to a lot of modern folk. They say, yeah, I can kind of get that, you know. I can kind of get this idea of the resurrection sort of growing with time, that it really didn't happen originally. The problem with it is, the problem with that argument is namely this. It fails to make sense of the cultural context in which this book was written. It fails to basically two things I want to say. Well, I want to say a lot more than two things, but two things right now. Okay. One is that mankind is not smarter today than he was than we were 2,000 years ago. We have more knowledge, but we're not smarter. You see the incredible kind of intellect that is represented in past history and the kind of engineering feats and construction that was able to be accomplished using very limited tools. And it's like, no, we're not smarter today. We just have more knowledge. And another thing is we're not less gullible today than they were back then. I mean, just one example, Donald Trump. Okay, I got it in there. Sorry. We continue to be gullible people. I mean, mankind hasn't changed. C.S. Lewis calls that idea that we're better just because we were born later, chronological snobbery. And a lot of people are guilty, in our culture in particular, we're guilty of chronological snobbery. Oh yeah, we're further ahead, we're less gullible, we're smarter. That's not true. And so I just want to give you 5 points. They're on your programs on an outline. Why should we believe that Christ was raised? And the first is this. The documents were written far too soon, far too early to be myth or legend. The documents were written far too early to be myth or legend. You see, this whole idea that it kind of developed as a myth depends on time, depends on many, many decades and hundreds of years to go by for a myth, a full-blown legend to develop, especially one that people would actually believe. And the reality is that the New Testament documents that testify to the reality of Christ's resurrection, they came within just a few decades. In fact, the earliest testimony is in 1 Corinthians 13, which was written, every scholar agrees, really, within 15 or 20 years of the death of Christ. This is a short period of time. It's within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. And so Paul, he writes and he says, hey, what I passed on to you, what I've received as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to, and then he names them off, Cephas, and then to the 12, and after that he appeared to more than 500 at one time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. What he's basically saying is, you can go check it out. They're right here. 500 at one time, they were there, they saw him. You go ask them. This is not a legend that developed slowly. Within 20 years, at the most, after Christ died, Paul is still saying, hey, this happened. They all saw it. Check it out. I was also noticing as I was reading this last week through Mark chapter 15, the account of Jesus' crucifixion, and how on the road, as he was carrying his cross on the way to Golgotha, what happened? A man named Simon from Cyrene came by, and the soldiers grabbed him and said, okay, you're going to carry the cross. And Mark then says, Simon of Cyrene, and then he identifies him, the father of Alexander and Rufus. Well, who were Alexander and Rufus? Well, Alexander and Rufus were in the church. They were probably in the church in Rome. Mark's writing this from Rome, and he's saying, hey, you want to know about it? Go ask Alexander and Rufus, because their dad was the one who carried the cross. And they can tell you all about it. So this stuff is not, it doesn't read like legend material. It's not like, anybody ever play the game of telephone, or some people call it, whisper down the alley or whatever, where you whisper something to someone and then they whisper it to the next and whisper to the next and whisper to the next. And, you know, it starts out, my dad went to work, and then it ends up at the end, you know, the last person says, my dog is a jerk, you know, and it's like it changed. This is not this kind of stuff. The gospel accounts, they demonstrate a careful attention to detail. And one of the things that we are discovering in our day, there's been an awful lot of study about oral cultures and how oral tradition is passed along. And what we are discovering is that there's, in oral cultures, such as the culture in Jesus' day, oral cultures give special attention to the way in which history is passed along, and that in fact they have demonstrated that you can go back hundreds of years in generations of people able to trace their ancestors in a completely oral culture, and it stays consistent year after year after year, because in an oral culture there's special attention to detail and you hold on to it. And so the ideas that are passed along don't have the ring of myth. In fact, there wasn't even time for a myth to develop. C.S. Lewis, he says it this way. He says, I've been reading poems, romances, vision literature, legends, and myths all my life. He's a scholar, a literary scholar, or he was, at Oxford. And he says, I've been reading this kind of stuff all my life. It's my business. I know what they are like. I know that none of them are like this. None of them are like this. Of this gospel text, there are only two possible views. Either this is reportage, in other words, genuine historical reportage, or it's Or else some unknown ancient writer, without known predecessor or successors, suddenly anticipated the whole technique of modern novelistic, realistic narrative. You see, fiction or legend material in the past wasn't written like this. So that's one reason that I put my faith in this. The second reason I put my faith in it is that the accounts are too problematic to be fabrications. The accounts are too problematic to be fabrications. You're saying, wait a minute, Steve, you just are contending that this is good, valid historical material, and now you're saying the accounts are problematic? What's problematic about them? What do you think? The problematic part about them is that the very first witnesses were women. And if you're concerned about eyewitnesses and evidence and being able to support that evidence, and you're living in the first century, you don't want to have your primary witness being women. Not your first eyewitnesses, because in a court of law, their testimony wasn't even accepted. And you say, man, that sucks. And it does. It was terrible, but it was the reality. Why? Well, because, you know women. Sorry. You know, it was considered that women are flighty and that they're emotional. And that they're driven by their hormones, and you just can't trust that testimony. So there was great pressure on the early church to change the story, to say, no, it wasn't first the women, or to kind of leave that part out. And again, it's like Mark and the other gospel writers are saying, hey, I wrote what I wrote. I'm sticking with it. It was the women. They were the first ones there. And by the way, they were scared spitless when they left. He doesn't hide the reality of it. This doesn't read like someone trying to make a story play to the audience. Doesn't play to the audience. And that makes it even more believable. The third thing. The people of Jesus' day did not expect a resurrection anything like this. They didn't expect a resurrection like this. You see, if this was made up, if it was a legend that kind of developed with time, it would have played into their expectations. This is completely contrary to their expectations. It's assumed that people in Jesus' day were more open to the possibility of a resurrection than we are. They weren't. The Greeks, the idea, their concept of the body is that the body was vastly inferior to the soul. And that any good self-respecting spirit who left his body would just rejoice and say, I'm free! I'm free! No more of that, that old body, man. A spirit would never go back to his body. Resurrection life wouldn't be life in a body, because that would be below his dignity. That was completely contrary to Greek thought. It was also contrary to Jewish thought from this perspective. The Jews, at least some of them, not all of them, but many of them did anticipate a resurrection. But the resurrection was absolutely tied to the concept of God establishing his new kingdom and his new order. There would never be an independent resurrection. So if you came to a Jew and said, you know what? Your friend has been raised from the dead. He would say, oh, right. Right, sure. And The Romans are still in control. And the new order has not been established. And there's still wars and rumors of wars. And the lion is not yet laid down with the lamb. Come on. The Jewish concept was that resurrection happens, but when it happens in one big, glorious move of God. And so this idea that Jesus alone, by himself, would rise again from the dead was completely contrary the way in which it was lived out, completely contrary to anything they were expecting. The fourth thing is this. Empty tomb plus multiple eyewitnesses equals high degree of historical certainty. Empty tomb plus multiple eyewitnesses equals high degree of historical certainty. If you just had the empty tomb, you wouldn't have necessarily concluded that there had been a resurrection. People could say, well, I don't really understand it. I don't get it exactly, but the body's not there. But we don't know where it is. You wouldn't necessarily conclude that a resurrection had taken place. But there were eyewitnesses. And if there were just eyewitnesses, you could argue for perhaps that, okay, these 500 who were there who saw Jesus all at once, maybe they just ate the wrong mushrooms that day. And so they all saw it and convinced each other. But the fact is that you've got both. You could go back and you could look at the tomb and it was empty and no one came up with a body. And you could talk to the witnesses and they would verify independently from each other, no, I saw him. And, well, yeah, we saw him. We were walking along the road. And no, I mean, and 500 of us saw him all at once. And so we have both. In addition, those early witnesses, and this really raises the bar of their credibility, they were willing to die for what they testified to. Blaise Pascal, he says it this way, I believe those witnesses that get their throats cut. If you're willing to let your throat get cut for something, it raises your believability to a great extent. Now, at least it raises this reality. They were absolutely convinced of the reality. I mean, I get it that people will die for something as false, but not when they know it to be untrue. So they were convinced of what they had seen. Fifth thing is this. This new resurrection-centered view of reality absolutely exploded onto the scene. The first Christians believed that the future resurrection now had already begun with Jesus. And they believed that Jesus' transformed body was different than anything that anybody had thought of before. I mean, he's physical. He eats fish with them, but he appears and disappears at will. It's like something no one had anticipated. And they believe that that's where we're going. It was a cultural paradigm shift, and it happened overnight. And the thing is that cultural paradigm shifts don't happen overnight, but this one did. A group of first century Jews began worshiping a human being as divine. Greeks might do that. Greeks might feel like, well, sometimes the gods come and appear, in human form among us and walk among us. No Jew ever believed that or thought that or anticipated that. But within just a very few years, tens of thousands of Jews were doing exactly that. We're worshiping a man as God. This completely unprecedented view of the resurrection captivated the then known world and spread throughout it. So let's just review again the facts that we've got. We've got Jesus. He was dead, no question. Spear in his side. He's placed in a stone tomb, cold, sealed with a rock. He's buried according to typical custom, wrapped in cloths, wrapping around his head. The tomb is then sealed and guarded by either the temple guard or Roman guards, most likely Roman guards because it was Pilate who assigned them. A Roman soldier, the punishment for quitting your post was death. The punishment for falling asleep on a watch was possibly death, or at the very least, a gauntlet of cudgels and being beaten as you go through them. These were serious dudes. The disciples, they went on their way with great fear and great sorrow, convinced that it was the end. 2 days later, a group of women go to the tomb, discover that it's empty. At first, they hold it to themselves, then they report to the disciples. They go and check it out, and they find that it's indeed empty. And then Jesus appears to multiple people on multiple occasions for a period of 40 days. And then, boom, he ascends into heaven, and there's no more appearances. They stop. People don't keep seeing him. This is not a hallucination that continues to happen. And these early believers proclaim the news that Jesus is raised again from the dead, and that he is in fact Lord of all. And because he's Lord of all, he is the Lord of you. And he makes a demand on every one of our lives. You know, I'm convinced if you don't short-circuit the process with a philosophical bias against the possibility of miracle, the best way to explain the evidence is what? That it happened. That it happened. And we are not fools for believing it, as Dan Brown would want us, you know, would want to say, and others, many others. The early Christians, this is a quote on the back of your notes from N.T. Wright, the early Christians did not invent the empty tomb, the meetings or sightings of the risen Jesus. Nobody was expecting this kind of thing. No kind of conversion experience would have invented it. No matter how guilty or how forgiven they felt, no matter how many hours they poured over the scriptures, to suggest otherwise is to stop doing history and enter into a fantasy world of our own. In other words, those who contend that Christians just believe this stuff because they want to aren't doing real history. That actually the burden of proof lies on not just on the believers, but on those who do not believe as well, to explain the evidence that's there. And I love that. And I love the reality then that it's like, then it you know, I've had times in my life where I've really struggled to believe. I'm sure all of us have. Where sometimes it's like the circumstances of life just seem so crazy or so difficult. And it's like, well, wait a minute, God, where are you in this? And am I maybe just believing this because I want to? Am I maybe just believing this because others around me have done so, and so they just influenced me in this train, and I'm just going that direction? And so sometimes I've been a questioner. And what I always come back to is, but how do I explain the empty tomb and the eyewitnesses? They stand there as this bulwark in history, this central point in history. And so We don't believe because we wish it. We believe because the evidence points to it. And if I confess with my mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in my heart that God has raised him from the dead, I will be saved. And if Jesus rose again from the dead, then the cross matters. In fact, the cross is meaningful. The cross is so meaningful. Why? Because I need it. I've got to have it. Because it's my salvation. Addie's going to sing a song about the cross, about the reality of the resurrection, and about the reality of what the cross means to each of us. And so, Lord, I pray that as she sings, that you would make yourself known to us. It's not in the same way, Jesus, that you appeared to the disciples. But you yourself said, hey, blessed are those who believe without seeing. You said that to Thomas. But it's not like we're just throwing ourselves willy-nilly into this thing. We're believing this because it makes total sense. And so, Lord, I believe and help my unbelief. And help us to really get it, Lord. Help us to get the cross.